The Pacific Group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization that more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here will be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Good evening, my name is Jennifer and I'm an alcoholic. Well, welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. He has two 10-minute speakers followed by a main speaker. Speakers, please note you'll be given a 5-minute and a 1-minute reminder when it's time to wrap up your talk. Our first 10-minute speaker tonight is Artie A.
Hi everyone, my name is Artie and I'm an alcoholic. My sponsor's name is Julie W. My sobriety date is September 10, 2017, and you guys, Pacific Group, is my home group. I can't believe I am speaking here. I knew one day it was eventually gonna happen because this group is incredibly inclusive. So thank you so much to Marty. I am so nervous, but as nervous as I am, this is an honor and privilege to be speaking in front of the group that has saved my life on multiple different occasions. So thank God there's a format because I would be way more nervous than I actually am. So what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. So I immigrated from India to America at 2 years old, and right off the bat, I was comparing myself to everyone around me. I felt like I didn't belong. There was something wrong with me. I wasn't thin enough. I wasn't smart enough, fast enough, strong enough. And on top of that, I felt like my parents didn't love me. I had this belief system that my parents loved my siblings more than they loved me. And obviously, you know, I hear people say all the time, like, you know, that doesn't make me an alcoholic. And it's so true. It doesn't make me an alcoholic, but I used all of these reasons or these excuses to use and drink and basically engage in self-sabotaging behavior. So my first drink was when I snuck out of the house because my parents didn't let me do anything. So I went to this party a block away and I had whiskey for the first time, and it did everything an alcoholic could want. It made me funnier. It made me more confident. It made me present, because that's what we want. We want to be present. And that's what it did for me. So that all I wanted was more and more and more of that. And so I didn't know what a limit was. And so I was 8 shots in and I threw up everywhere while I was having sex for the first time. And that guy ended up being my boyfriend. Clearly shows how low my standards were, but we ended up breaking up, which further added to my pain, which then propelled more drinking and more using. And then in college, you know, I thought college was about drinking and experimenting and going to parties. So like, you know, when my friends and my roommates, when they didn't want to drink and party and they wanted to stay home and study, I was silently resentful at them. How dare you take my fun away from me? It's all about me. I'm so selfish, right? And so I went to Coachella for like the third time, and I was like experimenting with so many different drugs, and I was taking like 8 or 9 at the same time. And I ended up waking up in a hospital at UC San Francisco at a liver transplant list and a unit, and I was about to get liver failure. And luckily, you know, I was young, I was 21 years old, and my liver grew back. And not once did I think like, hey, you know, maybe I should like change my behavior. No, because it's like I wanted bad things to happen to me. It's like I didn't care if I died. And so my parents took me out of college. They brought me back home. And in my opinion, it's harder to hide alcohol than it is to hide drugs. So I got really heavily into opiates. I've been a huge thief my whole life. And so I learned how to pick locks from YouTube in a couple of days. Locks are an illusion. And so, you know, my aunt and uncle, they're doctors, they're millionaires. They have a drawer filled with cash. And so I would steal tens and thousands of dollars from them every time we would have a family gathering. And so I have $100,000 amends to make one day, but we'll deal with that when we get there. So that funded my addiction and alcoholism. And I didn't think like, hey, one day I'm going to run out of that, because we don't think about, you know, that. We don't think about the consequences. So eventually I did run out, and all I could think about was my next highs. And I did something that, you know, I didn't think I would ever do. I stole $5,000 from my parents and they found out. And then that led me to go to rehab after rehab after rehab. And finally, I landed at this one rehab where I had no more support anymore. Like, my parents were done with me. They gave me enough chances. And so I didn't have friends. I didn't have anything. So I was like, hey, why don't I kill myself? And I looked up how to kill myself. I was about to drive to the store to go get a bunch of pills to overdose. And then I thought, wait, I don't have to die. I could just get high. So I went to this guy's house who I met in another rehab. He had sepsis, so his fingers were amputated from dirty needles, so I had to give him a shot of heroin. He started turning blue right in front of me and started ODing. And so, you know what my head told me? My head said, hey, this is my chance to go steal his drugs. And I was already trying to justify his death. I was like, that's not going to be on me. He did that to himself. And that, in that moment, I realized I am completely powerless over this disease. There is like this monster that is inside of me that I am giving all of my faith and my trust in, instead of giving it to the higher power that I didn't have at that time yet. And so the cops came, he ended up living, thank God, otherwise I'd be in jail. And for some reason, they didn't arrest me. So I was walking down the streets of Indio, and I just with a bunch of heroin and myself, and I didn't even have clean water to get high with. And so I was just like, how did I get here? I had that moment of clarity we always talk about, and this wasn't supposed to be my life. I wasn't supposed to go from motel to motel and, you know, ODing every single weekend, meeting random strangers. So I called my mom, they gave me another chance. I went back home and I decided to get sober, because if I don't, I'm gonna kill someone, I'm gonna die, or I'm gonna end up in jail. And, you know, I didn't join AA right when I got sober because I thought I had done the AA thing. And, you know, I just had a really big higher power at that time. I believed in myself and I was just so sick and tired of everything that I stopped. I moved to LA. I landed the job of my dreams. And I ended up getting into a relationship that obviously I didn't have any like emotional sobriety. So that ended up failing. And at 8 months sober, I thought I was going to relapse again. So I found myself in Monday Night, Ohio. And as soon as I sat down, someone said to me, people stay sober here. And that gave hope to a hopeless alcoholic like me. And I got myself a sponsor. She told me where to go the next day and the next day and the next day. And every single meeting I went to in Pacific Group, multiple women came up to me and gave me their phone numbers and then called me the next day. It was just like, they taught me that like, our word matters. Like, they did what they intended on doing. And so like, if we don't do what we intend to do, right, then you don't matter. I don't matter. My word doesn't matter. And that just gives me another reason to use and drink. And so I learned a big lesson right when I entered this group. And then I went through the fourth step with her. And I learned more lessons where, you know, I would overthink everything. I would think, are you my friend or are you not my friend? Should I sit there? Should I sit over there? And everything was just like, my head was so loud. And then a simple thing like, hey, what they think of you is none of your business. Like, oh my gosh, so profound. Like, why didn't I think of that? Like, the smallest tools are the most powerful and what I use in my life every single day. Another thing I learned was my parents, they did love me. They just didn't have the tools to parent me the way I wanted to be parented. They had their own fears they needed to deal with. And I had a sense of compassion come inside of my body. And, you know, I don't need my parents to parent me. I have my own higher power. You can pick whatever higher power you want, but for me, I use he and she. So my higher power is my mother and my father. And that's what feels most comfortable for me. And so that's what I do. And this group taught me how to show up for the people in my life. My brother is a schizophrenic and he's in the hospital right now. And, you know, my dad, he isn't a sensitive person. Like, he doesn't show affection. And, we didn't even start saying I love you until when I got sober. So like 3 years ago. And so the other day, I'm at home now. I lost my job because of the pandemic. Even went through like another breakup that was incredibly difficult, but we can do like hard things in sobriety. And that's what I'm learning. And so he came up to me and was just like, hey, I'm worried about him. And I just told him the things you guys tell me, like, hey, let's just get through today. You are showing up for him, by not contacting him because he asked for space. Like, that is something you guys taught me, and I wouldn't have been able to say any of that if you guys didn't tell me that when I was feeling that same way. And, you know, you guys gave me friends. You guys gave me an incredibly kind and loving sponsor that shows up for me in a kind and gentle way. And I don't know how much time I have left. And she doesn't, you know, feel validated based on like my sobriety, like how I run my program. And like, I want to be like that, you know, I don't want to feel validated based on like other people's actions. So I don't know, this group has taught me so much. And, you know, now, like, one step at a time, like that, taking action, that's another thing that I learned. I lost my job, and now I'm trying to start my own business. And it is going so great. Oh my gosh. Whoops. Yeah. And like, I have 34,000 followers on Instagram now. And that I was only able to do that because I applied the things you guys taught me and just took one step at a time. And now I feel like, you know, slowly my dreams are coming true. This isn't always easy. And one thing I always say to myself is also progress, not perfection. And also, I just want to tell the newcomer, this is something that comforted me when I was new. And it was, we will love you until you can love yourself. And like, that was something that really comforted me. So just show up and be honest, and we will be there for you. And, you know, no pressure. Okay, that's all I got.
Thank you. Our second 10-minute speaker is Fernando H.
Hi, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Fernando. Excuse me. Thank you, Marty, for asking me to do this. And I'm really grateful to be here and to be of service in this way in Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome to the newcomers and people, happy birthday to the people taking cakes later in the meeting. And thank you, Artie. I wish I'd talked before you, actually, because that's going to be hard to follow. Really awesome message. Really loved your share. And thank you. Because I've worked the steps out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous with a sponsor inside of a home group, I have a sobriety date of April 28, 1998. And for that, I owe Alcoholics Anonymous my life. My Pacific group is my home group. My sponsor is Jeff N. He's in the square with Duffy. Hi, Jeff and Duffy. And I'm really grateful to be here tonight. The reason I say that the steps sponsorship in a home group had something to do with my sobriety is because for 8 years, I started getting sent to Alcoholics Anonymous in my teens by judges and school administrators and courts. And so I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous and treatment centers and other 12-step programs for 7 or 8 years before my current sobriety date. And 22 and a half years ago, I got a sponsor, I got a home group, and I worked the steps and I stayed sober, where before that, for 8 years, I just went in and out and didn't stay sober. So I know that my current sobriety is not an accident, good luck, or chance. It's because I put in the work to get and keep a sobriety date. So I know that there's a correlation between me staying sober and the work that I've done and that I continue to do today. And I'm grateful that I knew that, because in previous sobrieties, I thought that the lucky people got to stay sober, or that the popular people got to stay sober, or you had to get in with the right group to stay sober. And, you know, and really it's not, you know, the difference is, in my experience and in the friends I've made and the people I've gotten to know over the past 22 years is that it's, you know, it's those that work the steps and be of service get to stay, and those that don't. And I'm grateful I know that today. I was born in Los Angeles. My parents were actually born in Los Angeles. And so I've grown up in LA, and it doesn't make me an alcoholic, but it made drinking a lot of fun as a young person, because there was a lot of places to drink, even as an underage person. A lot of after hours underground clubs, you know, it was easy to get a fake ID. It was just a lot of fun. And, you know, as a really small child, I was a bookworm and quiet and shy and introverted and super self-conscious and uncomfortable. And I always felt like I didn't fit in, and like other kids were cooler than me. And they had like a secret group that they met with, and they talked and they shared it. You know, they had secrets and shared stuff between each other, but I couldn't be in the inner group. Like when I showed up, they put on a front, like I wasn't, you know, oh, he's here now. Let's not talk about what we talk about when he's not here. So I just felt on the outside. And that's before I left my grandma's backyard. I'm talking about my cousins and my siblings, and just always perpetually an outsider. And then a cousin invited me to drink when I was in middle school. And I told my mom I was spending the night at his house. We snuck out and we drank, and it was magic. It was like, it was a spiritual awakening. You know, all the shyness and introversion and feeling not a part of and separate and different, it went away. And there was kids there that older kids that were in high school that I was terrified of, that I wasn't afraid of him anymore, and I could talk to him. When you're a shy kid, you know, and you find magic and release and freedom like that, you know, I was in. I wanted to party. After that, I forgot about school. I had good grades. Thank you. Those went away. I just cared about partying. And, you know, and started getting in trouble, and it's a progressive disease. So I did manage to get into college. So after high school, I went to college in Orange County. And my senior year at the university, you know, my fiance left. I got kicked out of our apartment. I was literally crawling out of the bushes to go to class, but I held up my high GPA in college as an excuse for why I didn't have a problem. And I'd been to AA, like I said, 7 or 8 years before that. And then I came out of a blackout in downtown Fullerton in the Alano Club, because their Alano Club used to be in the middle of the bars. And a guy talked to me and took me to my first home group. And I met my sponsor there, Jeff. And he talked to me on my first day of this sobriety. And he asked me if I was a newcomer. And I said, you know, no, I've been around AA for 7 or 8 years. Like, I'm not new. And he said, what's your sobriety date? And I had drank earlier that day, so I didn't have a sobriety date. And, you know, he asked me, he said, you know, what are you going to do different this time? What are you going to, you know, you're not new. You've been to AA before. What are you going to do that's different? And I told him the truth. I have never gotten a sponsor and worked the steps. And he told me to ask this guy named Keon to be my sponsor. And he could see that I balked and didn't want to do it. And he said, dude, it's not a marriage. Like, you're overthinking it. Just ask him to be your sponsor. If you change your mind, don't call him tomorrow. And he was sneaking that one day at a time thing in on me. And so I asked Keon to be my sponsor. We started working steps, and I got a commitment. I got a big book, and getting into the book was super important, because that helped me see how I was just like you, how I was a real alcoholic. The big book is so important to my recovery and to me being here and staying here, you know. And I always, Keon told me, the first thing he did is took me to the first page in the forward to the second edition, where it says, we learned in 16 years since the first printing of the first edition of the big book that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another alcoholic, was vital to permanent sobriety. And so he kind of said, that starts with your sponsor. If you do not get a sponsor, you can't strenuously work one alcoholic with another, getting through the steps, and it continues with sponsorship. Today, I talked to my sponsor. Today I talk to people I sponsor. I always am willing to sponsor people. I have commitments in my home group. I always say yes to AA because I never said no to alcohol and drugs, like our first speaker said. I've never said no to alcohol and drugs, but then I'm going to show up in AA and start picking and choosing and saying no to an opportunity to save my own life and to serve others. When I serve you, my life gets better. When I serve me, my life gets darker and I get sicker. So me saving lives begins with asking someone to sponsor me, because like it says in chapter 7 in the big book, that, you know, that newcomers, welcome to the newcomers. You guys save our life. We don't, you know, we're not saving you. You're saving us. And I was 23 days sober, and my sponsor, Keon, made me help a guy with 3 days and said, stop, you know, because I, of course, had a million problems and a million complaints. And Keon said, why don't you go talk to that guy with 3 days? Tell him how you got 20 more days than him. Like, stop thinking about yourself. Selfishness is your problem. Unselfishness is the solution. And in this group, there's an opportunity every day to get out of myself, think about and help you, and get relief from the bondage of self, which is really my problem. You know, page 23 says, therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. And, you know, then on page 24, it says, when this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he has probably placed himself beyond human aid, and unless locked up, may die or go permanently insane. So it's not my drinking and partying that are my disease. My disease is in my thinking, and my disease can kill me sober. It doesn't need drugs and alcohol to kill me. My mind, my alcoholism will kill me sober. But luckily in this group, I always have an opportunity. You guys are my defense against that disease and against myself, my worst enemy. And I'm grateful to be here. Thanks again. Thanks for letting me share.
Main speaker tonight is Rick K.
Hello, everyone. My name is Rick, and I am an alcoholic. And thank you, Fernandez and Arta. Thank you so much. And Marty, thank you for the phone call. You could have knocked me over with a feather. And I'm just absolutely thrilled to be here tonight. I'm kind of a garden variety alcoholic. I used to drink, eh? I loved booze. I really loved it. I'd been the runt of the litter. I relate to you, Fernandez. I was just a little guy, and all the other guys seemed cool, and I just didn't feel cool at all. I had stick out ears and a big nose and a beard apparently, and I ended up being that kid that just loved booze, you know. I'd start drinking, and then I'd end up being the guy that drove everyone else home, and because I seemed to be able to hold it better, and I had a doctor tell me once, no, Rick, that just means that you have a fatty liver, has nothing to do with your manliness. And I think it was back in 1985 at a roundup that I heard Clancy say that it made him feel like real men look. And I don't think I ever related to a statement more than that in my entire life. You know, I was a goof. I was the guy that drove people crazy and couldn't keep my mouth shut. I'd say the wrong thing at the right time. And please don't take me to a funeral because I'll make someone laugh. I was just the wrong guy at the right time. But I loved that drink, you know. I loved that drink. And we thought we were cool. You know, we used to buy a wine called 410. We used to say, come alive for $1.05. And we drink 410 wine until it came out our nose. And then, I still felt insecure. I still felt in between any drunk. I still didn't feel part of. But I tell you, I'd get a few drinks under my belt and I'd go stand at the edge of the bar. And I'd feel totally different, you know. I'd stand there and I'd look around that bar and I'd think, well, the men are going to be shaken and the women are going to be stirred, you know. I was totally delusional. I was terrified of girls, so I'd talk to myself about it, but I just didn't have it. And it got worse and worse. Blackouts and being arrested for drunk driving. And then I decided I'd become a chef, and I left school. And I thought I was going to be a connoisseur, apparently. And apparently all I became was a common sewer. I drank like a pig. I just drank like a pig. But I met this really cute girl while I was cooking at the most expensive country club in Ontario, Canada. She came from a wonderful big Irish Catholic family, and everything about her was wonderful. And I was smitten. And so my whole focus went away from being cool to being the right guy for her. But I was still drinking. And she went into nursing school. So I was living this in another town short ways away. And I started living this schizophrenic life where I was drunk all week. And then she'd come home in the weekend and I'd have hives from drinking too much. And I'd be twitchy. I'll never forget. I asked her, I finally proposed to her. I had to rent a car because I'd been charged with drunk driving again. And my car was impounded. And so I rented a car and I proposed to her, and we went and told her family. And then I told my dad, and he said, "What are you doing to her? You know, like, leave her alone, you know?" Because I was a terrible drunk. I was the kid that parked his car in the middle of the front lawn and left it there at his home. But the most beautiful thing I ever saw in my entire life was my wife walking up the aisle. She was absolutely radiant. And I really, really wanted to be a good husband. I wanted to be that husband that she'd look across the table and give you that knowing look. You know, that look that says, "That's my old man." You know that look, guys? Me either. I never did get that. Within 8 years, it was an absolute train wreck and disaster. And I'd moved her across the country from Ontario to Vancouver, BC. I ended up getting in trouble one Christmas with my drunkenness. And I promised her I'd go to the ANA. I didn't want you to think I was an alcoholic. So I borrowed a jacket and a tie so I wouldn't look like I was one of you, maybe, I guess. I don't know. And it started a revolving door thing for me for 10 years. And I was in and out of AA for 10 years. I got in a lot of trouble. My last time I got charged with drunk driving, or where I came from, impaired driving. And by then I'd moved to Edmonton, and I'd come home from court, and I didn't want to play that game with her one more time where she would be hurt by my behavior, and she'd give me that silent treatment for 3 or 4 days. And then finally, and I'd wait till I could see the emotion building up in her. And then I'd say something that would make her blow up at me, and she'd get all that emotional energy off, and then I could offer her alternatives. And I came back from court so defeated that I said something. I had a plan. It wasn't a very good one, but I said, "Maybe I should move out." Now, what I expected was for her to say, "Oh, you poor thing. You know, you've had a bad, bad month." And she packed. Within a very short time, I was standing on my porch of my cute little bungalow in West Edmonton with my matching alcoholic luggage, a pair of green garbage bags. My first thought was, this didn't go as planned. My second thought was, she'll never find another guy like me. And within 5-6 weeks, I'd had a couple seizures. I was burning through money that I didn't own, that I'd borrowed. And I was living in a flop apartment. She actually had, and I didn't want to be that guy. I didn't want to be the guy that hurt her and let her down. The opposite of love I've discovered sober is not hate. The opposite of love is indifference. And I never got to the point where I didn't care what she thought of me or what her family thought of me or whatever. But I ended up on a skid row of flop house, and it was a semi-furnished apartment. Let me get that straight. It had a mattress and a kitchen table and a chair. And one time she came over, and I was sitting in the middle of the living room on the carpet, and I was crying with my whiskey because I felt so all alone. And she started tapping on the door, trying to see if I was in there, because she was afraid I was going to hurt myself. And all I could think was, stay away, get away from me. I just don't want to do this, you know. And then I came back to AA one more time after a trip through a treatment center. And I got a spot. I made a mistake. This time I got a sponsor, and he started giving me these jobs to do. I never heard the word commitment, but he gave me jobs to do. And one of the jobs, he put me on a committee to be on the literature committee of the Edmonton Spring Roundup in 1986. My sober date is August 8th, 1985. But I want to tell you that I was dry, but I wasn't sober. I was sitting at that literature table, and the Al-Anon speaker was in the next room. It was Elsa C. And he didn't want to hear the Al-Anon speaker. And he was from Laguna Beach. His name was Joe. And he came over to the literature table and he said to me, hey, kid, have you seen this pamphlet before? And then he said, and how are you doing? And I was chain smoking, because that's what I did then. It's what gave me my deeper voice, actually. And he said, I'm doing pretty good. You know, my life is much more manageable. And he looked at me, and he said, by who? And then he pulled his big book out from under his arm and he started on me. And Joe shared with me his big book. He shared his first three steps, and he set a fire in me, because he was the first person that ever communicated recovery to me in terms I truly understood. And it was eyeball to eyeball, one-on-one. And the fire got lit. It absolutely got lit in me. And I got so excited about AA, I ran back to my sponsor and I said, Terry, did you know this was in the big book? And I started showing him this stuff. And he says, what'd you think I've been telling you? You know? And it changed my life. See, one person lit my fire. And I got this urge to be part of you, and to actually get busy with this whole thing. And I've never looked back. My wife and I got back together, and I started out in the basement on the basement couch. And if you're a drunk, don't ever buy a couch with buttons. It's a no place to sleep. And I ended up back upstairs, and I married Irish Catholic. And when you marry Irish Catholic, there are certain expectations about children. Otherwise, they think there's something wrong with you. Me, that is, I should say. And so we just started trying. And I learned, she was a labor and delivery nurse, and I learned stuff, guys, that guys should never know. I learned about calendars and thermometers and not wearing tight jeans and not sitting in hot bathtubs. We still didn't have a baby. We finally went to a doctor, and he said, for all intents and purposes, you'll probably never conceive. So we started the process of adoption. I was 18 months sober, and I went to my sponsor, and I said, what do I tell this social worker when she comes into my house, he or she comes into my house? Do I tell them I'm an alcoholic? And I was right in the raw of my step three. You know what I decided? I decided either I'm all in or I'm not in at all. And so the poor social worker came into my house, sat on my couch, and I said, "Hi, would you like a cup of tea? I'm in AA." And I went and made tea, you know. I told on myself. Apparently, drug addicts never do that. Us alkies, we line up to tell on ourselves. And 3 weeks later, the phone rang. In those days, I had a home office for Maxwell. I was a Maxwell House guy for my province. And the woman on the other end of the line, she said, "I'm not your social worker. I'm the department head. And are you the alcoholic?" And then she paused. She was just rotten to me, you know. And it seemed like 40 minutes later, it was probably 20 seconds later, she said, "First of all, as an adoptive couple, we think you're wonderful. Secondly, I really liked what you said Saturday night at the Camel Club. And my first son came into my life 32 years ago on a hot August day. And then my wife surprised me, and we had another son, homemade, as it were. And I've had a really rich life, you know. That first kid was a big, heavy kid. And I'm big, 6'2", and he got teased a lot. But I put him in swimming, and he loved the water because he felt free there. He wasn't clumsy, and he was free in the water. So I put him in swim club, and he swam. And at age 14, he came to me at 6'2" and 240 pounds, a big pudgy kid. And he said, "You know, Dad, someday I'm going to the Olympics." And AA taught me, you don't laugh at people's dreams, right? You just don't do that. And so I drove him to that damn pool 10 times a week for the next 10 years. And at age 18, he secured a Div 1 scholarship to swim in the NCAA. Last Wednesday, that kid has a little wife, and she presented me with my first grandson. You know, I'm getting a real life here, guys. A real life, you know. And I wasn't supposed to get one. When I was new in AA, I was terrified that you people in AA wouldn't understand that I didn't know anything about God. And some old timer said to me, he said, "You know, why don't you just look at it as instead of spiritual, break it into two words, spirit ritual. Find the rituals, that's the things you do over and over again, that lift your spirit and keep your feet firmly planted on the ground." And I understood that. And he said, "It's going to take some discipline." He said, "But discipline's no problem." He says, "Discipline comes from the ancient Greek word disciple, and it means to serve and to follow. So all you got to do is serve and follow that." And I'll tell you a funny story about that. I was in the hospital having kidney stones zapped on a really fancy piece of equipment. And I'm looking up at a monitor, and my heart rate's 104 beats a minute, and I'm terrified. I make kidney stones. It's what I do. I made over 170. Good at something, apparently. Anyways, I'm watching my heart rate at 104 beats a minute, and I'm terrified. So I started saying the Serenity Prayer. By the time I was through that Serenity Prayer, three times my heart rate was 74 beats a minute. This stuff works, you know? If I do what I'm told, this stuff works. Now, this old Joe guy that had helped me and lit my fire, I was sitting in a car with Clancy at one point, and I'd met Clancy 35 years ago, and it was after a roundup dinner, and I said to Clancy, I said, "Clancy, did you ever know a guy by the name of Joe Quinn?" And Clancy got the strangest look on his face, like, "Are you kidding me?" And then he got a soft look right after that, and he said, "Rick, I used to live in Joe Quinn's car when I first got sober." And that started a relationship with me and with your founder of your group. And we had visits quite often. And then when I retired, I didn't know what to do with myself. And I got terrified. You know, I'd had time off from my marriage before, and I got terrified that I was going to drive my wife crazy. So she said, "So I thought you were going to volunteer." So I went down, I had a friend who was the chef down at the homeless detox center. And I'd started out as a chef when I was young, but I'd become a chicken salesman of all things, a food broker. And I ended up going down there and I started cooking 2 and 3 days a week for free and for fun down the detox center. And then the phone started ringing. The people that I'd known from the manufacturing community started calling me and saying things like, I got 20 cases of chicken wings that are getting dusty. Can you use them? I've got 30 cases of turkey roast. Can you use them? Before you know it, I'm getting hundreds of cases of this stuff being donated, and Clancy helped me and coached me with that, how to keep a binder with all these people's names and call them on a regular basis. And he was right. Free and for fun is really good. It's really good. But I've been absolutely blessed. At one point, my wife and I, we split up, and we'd split the house, actually. She had the inside and I had the outside of all things. And I really thought I'd never get back in that house. I really thought that I was done. And I wasn't. I wasn't done. Because someone lit my fire. And we talk an awful lot about the big book and you got to do the steps. And yeah, you do. But I think a lot of us get our fire lit by someone who takes the time for us and makes an effort, makes an absolute effort to listen to us and to talk to us and to be there for us. And my life got saved by a skinny little guy at a roundup. He was he was a funny old guy. For the newcomers, I want to tell you something. If you hear nothing else in anything I say, I want you to know that I have a chronic, progressive, and fatal illness. It's chronic because I'll never get rid of it. It's progressive because it's always going to get worse. And I'm either going to die with it or I'm going to die from it. And it's my choice. It's absolutely my choice. I have never practiced the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to the best of my ability. Based on my ability, I can get ice cubes in a blizzard if I want to drink. But I've always practiced it to my willingness. If you're new, please stay willing. Please suit up and show up. I remember I was going to my first meetings in Vancouver, and there was an old guy there by the name of Angus. Angus Mackay. And at the end of his talk, he'd always say, we love you. We need you. Please keep coming back. And I looked to my right side at the guy like to say, is he for real? And he was smiling. So I looked to the guy on my left. Not only was that guy smiling, he had a tear in the corner of his eye. And I thought, what have I let myself into? But if you're new, please always go where the love is. Always go where the love is. When times are tough, go where the love is, where the people in your home group are. And for sure, we love you. We need you. And please keep coming back because this just keeps getting better. I don't know who's going to set you up and lit your fire if you're new. But keep going until you find those people that connect with you. Alcoholics Anonymous started by two people talking. And on page 180 of the big book, in italics or cursive or however you say that, Dr. Bob talks about how that Bill Wilson was the first person who ever talked to him in a way that he understood. It's so important. It's so important that we connect with each other. When I work down at the homeless detox, I'll put their food up for their lunch and I'll say, don't drink, go to meetings. And they'll give me that look like, buddy, give me a break, you know, some old guy telling them to go to meetings. And then I say to them, but you don't understand. I'm not like you. I am you. I really am you. Because I was in that place 35 years ago. And I know that there's a recovery today. So thank you, Marty, for asking me to talk. I probably talked too long and said far too little. And the mind and the heart will only absorb what the backside will endure. So I'll hang it up tonight. And thank you for being patient with me and listening to my tale. You know, the great gift in AA for me is I've reached the dizzying heights of dreadfully, boringly average. Two sons and a grandson. Can't beat that with a stick. Thank you for my life.
Celebrate AA birthdays at this meeting. We define sobriety as freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, anything which would affect you from the neck up. If your regular attendee of this meeting would like to take a cake with us, please email our scribe, Ann P., at birthdays@pacificgroupla.org.
Hi, everybody. My name's Ann, and I'm an alcoholic.
And please email her by 6:30. Otherwise, you have to wait until the following week to get recognized. We have several birthdays tonight. This week, we have a special guest singing a song.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear A.A.'s. Happy to you. Keep coming back.
Thank you, Hillary. We have several birthdays tonight. And our first birthday is for Samantha S. for 2 years. Her sponsor is Amy L. We have a 4-year birthday for Brandon D. His sponsor is Joey W. We have a 4-year birthday for Jillian N. Her sponsor is Julie R. We have a 4-year birthday for Nicole S. Her sponsor is Beth P. We have a 7-year birthday for Vincent T. His sponsor is John G. We have a 9-year birthday for Craig M. His sponsor is Bob W. We have an 11-year birthday for Mitch R. His sponsor is John G. We have a 16-year birthday for Karen M. Her sponsor is Joan VT. We have a 23-year birthday for Diane N. Her sponsor is Janice G. We have a 23-year birthday for Christine W. Her sponsor is Jill B. We have a 36-year birthday for Brian A. His sponsor is Tom B. We have a 38-year birthday for Debbie O. Her sponsor is Marilyn S. So we had a total of 12 birthdays of 177 years, the average being 14.75. What other home group can say that? Come on. Let's see here. We have a custom at the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each candle on our birthday cake at the end of the year. This candle money is our contributions to AA organizations worldwide. If you wish to participate in this custom, please email our treasurer, Betty H. at treasurer@pacificgroupla.org. Underneath special announcements, do we have an update